Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, part one of my interview with Kalamu Yassalam, whose new book, his first published novel, is Walkin' Blues, a meditation and speculation on the life and legend of Robert Johnson. Kalamu Yassalam is one of New Orleans' most prolific artists, editors, and activists, as well as teachers. He's the author of 5 books of poems, numerous essays, and 13 plays, documentaries too. He's a retired educator known for his work with the independent writing program Students at the Center. He was the founder of Black Art South, the NOMO Literary Society, and Runnegade Press. Today we're talking about a new book, his first published novel, Walkin' Blues. Kalamu, welcome.
Thank you very much. And it sounds like you're referring to somebody that is erudite and has done some time with public education and high school and college and what have you. And I'm wondering who you were talking about.
Oh, where would we be without you, Kalamu?
Because it took me 11 years after I graduated from high school to get an associate arts degree from Delgado University.
And you wrote all that time, didn't you?
Oh, I was writing all that time. I had been introduced to writing in 8th grade.
Wow.
7th grade, I was at Rivers Frederick Junior High School. I was inducted into photography by my industrial arts teacher, Mr. Conrad. And in 8th grade, Mrs. O.E. Nelson introduced me to Langston Hughes. She said, put your books away. I want you to hear something.
Wow.
And she had pulled out a little portable record player, and she played a recording of Langston Hughes reciting his poetry with a jazz band behind him. And that was in 8th grade. And up until that point, in 7th grade, when I had been introduced to photography, I would go around the school taking pictures of everything at Rivers Frederick Junior High School. And I thought that photography was going to be the way I describe it in a mythic, poetic style, I would say. I kissed photography.
Ah.
But I married writing.
Absolutely, you married writing.
That's the way it developed for me.
There's something you say in this book about Robert Johnson wanting to be, because the book is based on his life, wanting to be the kind of musician where people always remembered where they were when they first heard him.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds to me like Langston Hughes is that kind of touchstone for so many people, don't you think?
Yes. Langston Hughes, I would later find out he spent a whole summer in New Orleans.
Wow.
And Langston Hughes was the person that gave me permission to be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Be a world traveler and really be interested in what was going on in the world. Langston Hughes, as I found out later on, was part of a group of people who were invited by the then newly formed government of the Soviet Union in the 20s to go to Russia to work on a update of Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Wow.
Of course, it never happened.
Mm-hmm.
By the time they got to Russia, it was a big mess. So the Soviet Union gave them tickets back to their points of origin. And Langston Hughes, being Langston Hughes, decided not to go back through Europe. He wanted to go back through Asia.
Ah.
And then across the Pacific and then to the west coast of United States, which is what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the subconscious encouragements to me to travel. and see and see the world. So I ended up, I was in the army. I was in the, on a mountaintop in South Korea. I stood on the Great Wall of China and all that kind of stuff, and traveled through the Caribbean and South America as a result of being influenced by Langston Hughes. At the time, I didn't realize it. Looking back on it now, I see that this was one of the things that encouraged me to travel. And so I've traveled all around the world.
You know, when, the very first time I interviewed you, you said your philosophy was once a month out of the city, once a year out of the country.
Right, right. Yes, that used to be, big, again, Langston Hughes. Mm-hmm. Because once I started traveling, especially outside of the confines of the armed services, once I started traveling, I mean, I really learned so much, and I was so smitten by people around the world that I couldn't stop traveling for a while.
And you taught so much, too, traveling, I'm sure.
Traveling taught me a lot. When I came back, eventually, I became a founding member of the Black Collegian magazine.
Right.
I was the second editor. Norbert Davison was the first editor. And shortly thereafter, the founding of the magazine in 1960, I believe it was, Norbert left, and I became the editor. So for 12 years, I did that. And then after that, I was at the Jazz and Heritage Foundation for 4 years. And then after that, and I'm saying after that.
I know.
But all of this was going on at the same time. I was with the students at the Center Program and worked teaching school for a number of years. I forget how many years it was.
And then there were all those times you dedicated your Tuesday nights to Nomo Literary Society.
Oh, yeah.
I remember going to that group for 6 months and learning so much myself from you.
Nomo was the result. It's a funny thing. It's a funny story. I was working out at Southern University in New Orleans. I'd say working out at. It sounds more grandiose and official than it was. That was just Tommy Myrick and Dwight Webster were in charge of a summer program. And I was invited to be one of the poets working with the program. And as a result of working with the program, they decided that the program would be for Black males. And I'm teaching writing to Black males, one of whom is I see on a regular basis. And I was confronted by one of the people I was working with, and she came up to me and said, "What's this?" And I said, "What's what?" And she said, "You're doing a program and it's just for men."
Oh.
And I said, "Well, Keisha Brown Robinson."
Of course.
I said, "Well, Keisha, you know, I was asked, they asked me to do this program and I would do it." And I didn't know at the time period when I said I agreed to do it that it would just be for males. She said, "Yeah, but you got to do something about that." And I said, "Well, what do you suggest?" And she says, "Well, we need to have a program that's a writing program that's for men and women." And I said, "Okay, fine by me. I'm not opposed to that. I agree with you on that."
Yep.
And that's how Nomo Literary Society started. And it's a funny story, that comic tragic in the Greek sense. 10 years later, the program started, we're doing them. And I'm doing the program in what was Tom Dent, who was my mentor, in his house, which was owned then by Lolis Eli.
Right.
And his son, and Lolis Jr., who was in California now working, doing television work and what have you. But anyway, that's where we had the program and we would meet. That's where I think I first met you at that program. Well, that was as a result of Keisha saying, "You need to do something that, you know, that's for men and women."
And so many great writers came out of that group, Kalama.
Oh, well, I am blessed because so many people passed through that. I was looking at a picture, actually this morning, with some of the writers that Keturah Kendrick has written a magnificent book, but also Jarvis DeBerry.
Of course. Now, Karen Celestan.
Karen Celestan, who has novels that she's done and what have you. So a number of people, yeah, came out of
really
that.
Really great people.
And I think I didn't know any better. I just thought, you know, you're supposed to do that. You're supposed to help other people. You're supposed to.
Yeah.
That's what you were supposed to do.
And hard work. I mean, there were nights that group would work from 6 to midnight.
Right. Yeah.
Really work.
And the reason we met on Tuesdays is because I was traveling a lot at that time. And I wanted to make sure that we could have something that was consistent and wouldn't be interrupted by my traveling. Most of the traveling I did, I did on the weekends, beginning on Thursdays. I'd leave and go about here, there, and all around the country, and also across the water for a minute, and come back. But I would always try and be in New Orleans on a Tuesday afternoon. And so we met on Tuesdays. That's why we met on Tuesdays.
I woke up this morning, year round for my shoes. A bag of this, walking through.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kalamu Yassalam, whose new book, his first novel, is Walkin' Blues, a meditation and speculation on the life and legend of Robert Johnson. So let's talk about the time travel you did to write this book. How long have you been thinking about this book? When did it come along in your writing life?
Oh, I don't remember exactly when.
You've been writing about the blues forever.
I can say one of my first major awards was the ASCAP Deems Taylor Award for writing about music. But when I was at the Black Legion magazine, that overlapped with the period I was writing for Wavelength magazine. And I wrote on a regular basis for Wavelength about music. Music in general, jazz specifically, and New Orleans music. That's what I did. So that was, as the old folks say, that was the hand I fanned with, writing about music. Back, I can remember coming out here, and here being University of New Orleans, and in this very studio, talking about some of the things. So yeah, I've been writing a long, long time, and I guess I'm the blessings of my parents who taught me consistency. And whatever you decide to do, you do whatever you want to do. Whatever you decide to do, do it and do it well to the best of your ability. And do it consistently. Don't dabble. Don't be a dilettante.
Do it with all your might.
Right.
You know.
With all your might, everything.
So what was it about Robert Johnson that drew you to him as a fictional subject? What made you want to get inside his head and write this book?
Well, you assume I'm inside his head.
Well, that's true, but you're convincing.
Well, here's the thing, which many people will not know the connection. When I came back to the city from the Army is when I met Tom Dent.
Right.
And Tom Dent became my mentor. I'd visit him, and he'd tell me, have you read such and so? Have you looked at this? Have you done that? So forth and so on. And everything he told me, I did eventually. One of the pieces I'm working on now is about a man who was a professor out here for a bit, Marcus Christian.
Of course.
Tom introduced me to Marcus Christian. I didn't know Marcus Christian personally until Tom, and I got to shake Marcus Christian's hand and everything.
Wow.
But here's the thing, in later years, come to find out, Marcus Christian lived on the same street I did in the Ninth Ward, on St. Maurice Avenue, but he lived on the riverside of Claiborne Avenue, and I lived on the lakeside of Claiborne Avenue, so our paths didn't cross.
That's New Orleans for you, though,
yeah,
right there.
Right there. So that's how I got involved in that aspect of the literature. through Psalm Dent. Mm-hmm. Psalm introduced me to Marcus Christian. And I'm currently working on a book which was going to be an anthology of Marcus Christian's writings, which I probably still will do. But now I've decided I want to do something that covers the 20th century and New Orleans, because New Orleans was a major player in the 20th century. People don't really realize it. Again, to tell you a brief story, very brief. I'm in Nicaragua on a boat going on a river trying to get from the middle of Nicaragua, Managua, to Bluefields. I wanted to go to Bluefields because there was a black writer who was there in Bluefields and I wanted to meet. So I'm sitting on this, we get from Managua, which is the capital, we get to Roma, Rima, Nicaragua. It's in the middle of the country. It was raining and it was a mess, but we get there. I'm with another person. I don't speak Spanish. He speaks Spanish. We get there. Finally, with Rama, that's where it was. We were in Rama. And on our way to Bluefield, but we got too late to make the one ferry that went upriver. So sort of like you see in these movies, you get on a boat. And it's
going to have an adventure if you get on a boat.
Yeah. And the next morning, we got up early. We didn't want to miss it. My friend who spoke Spanish, he said, I'll go get the tickets. You stand in line. I'm standing in line to get on the boat. We finally get on the boat, and I'm skipping some parts because there's some other stuff that happened. But we finally get on the boat. I'm sitting there. Turns out the ferry was one of two boats that went back and forth from the middle of Nicaragua to the Atlantic coast. And what had happened was the Contras had attacked the boat, and one of the boats was sunk in their attack. And the other one, the one I was on, the captain refused to stop when the boat was attacked, and he kept going. He just kept piling it on. Well, it turns out I'm sitting there and I'm talking with a woman who was a nun, a religious figure, and she began talking to me and told me, she said, yeah, and this is the boat that kept going. I said, what do you mean kept going? She said, well, the boat was attacked. Both boats were attacked. One was sunk and this one kept going. In fact, where you're sitting, I'm sitting on the outside of the, on the deck. She said, right there, those are the bullet holes. I said, what? And I turn around, and sure enough, right where I'm sitting, there are bullet holes in the thing. And so that was me.
Yeah.
I could understand that the captain kept going and the ship and so forth, and I would be on. And I didn't think of it as, quote unquote, personal danger, but that was just part of the life I was living at the time.
And it makes you understand the traveling life of Robert Johnson.
Yeah.
And how precarious it was.
Right. And so it turns out that the Robert Johnson book that you refer to was originally intended to be three volumes. Then I said, it's going to be two volumes. And I only wrote one volume. The second volume, this book ends before Robert Johnson's death. But the second volume will deal with... It turns out Robert Johnson had gone to Canada, had gone to New York, was dissatisfied with living in both places, and came back to Mississippi and was poisoned and subsequently became legendary. And nobody really knows absolutely where he's buried, you know.
It's so interesting, though, Kalamu, because this book is so many things. It's a wonderful historical novel set in the 30s. Yeah. It really captures how difficult life was, how tenuous everything was, how desperate people were for money and food and survival. Is that something you took from things you had heard or things you read?
I was with the Free Southern Theater, and I went all over Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And so I had, how can I put it? I had a working knowledge of Mississippi, Mississippi life, people, and so forth and so on. And because I was with the Free Southern Theater, and we did performances all over the state of Mississippi, I was very familiar with, areas and areas that weren't on the map. There's one place we performed, I'll never forget that we performed there. It's called Harmony, Mississippi.
Uh-huh.
And we used to get, at the beginning of the week, we would get our itinerary of where we're going next and so forth. And me being me, I'm rather dense, so I'm standing. I said, don't give me no itinerary. Just tell me where we going. I said, and somebody said, well, here it is. We go in this place, that place, and so forth. And I said, one of the places they named, I said, damn, how many black people they got in that place? And the place was Utah.
Oh, my God.
So they told me, we're going to Utah. So I didn't think nothing of it, but I said, well, how many black people they got in Utah? And they said, fool, they got a lot of black people in Utah, Alabama. E-U-T-A-W, Alabama. And so I said, well, okay, here we go.
And I imagine there were places that hadn't changed a lot since the 30s. You saw a lot of things.
Yeah, hadn't changed. And would not change. It would mm-hmm. not be until well after the Civil Rights Movement that a lot of those places changed. And so I was blessed to have been part of those people who, on the one hand, quote unquote, brought culture to those places in terms of theater. We would perform. We performed in churches, in ballrooms, literally in fields where sharecroppers worked and what have you. But I also, and what was important, much more important than us traveling around and bringing culture to them, I learned a lot from those mm-hmm. people. And so that is part of what Robert Johnson grew out of. I knew those areas.
Yeah.
I wasn't writing about it from the outside. This was from the inside.
And you feel it when you read it because you write about like whole towns, like the children, the families, the old people. You get the whole picture of society.
Well, that's the way, when I was with the Free Southern Theater, that's the way we traveled. We had mm-hmm. One of these long station wagons at the time. And we'd have everything in the station wagon. And you pull into town, and okay, you're gonna stay with so and so, you stay with so and so, and you stay with so and so. Say okay, and that's the way we lived, traveled, and worked. So we got to know those places, not as places on the map, but as these are places where you go, where you actually lived, and you work with mm-hmm. people. And so that's, I guess I never thought about why I wrote the Robert Johnson, but it grew out of that, having had those sets of experiences working with people. And I guess anybody who reads the book, they would probably think that I knew these people intimately, but it grew out of working with the Free Southern Theater, mm-hmm. traveling about and actually living that life of moving about.
Well, I want people to know what a great book this is, because it is pure pleasure to read. It really is.
Well, thank you. And to wrap up this, quote unquote, this interview, it's very ironic that the next book I did, Seeing Black, mm-hmm. Photographer in New Orleans, 1840 and Beyond, it's not text heavy. It's visual, and it's the pictures, the images heavy. I'm a writer, but I'm not so infatuated with the word.
You're a Renaissance man is what that you are.
that I think about that's the only way to write. Mm-hmm. The books I want to do, a lot of different kinds.
Right, when they call to you.
Right.
We've been talking with Kalamu Yassalam about a wonderful new book, Walking Blues, about Robert Johnson. And Kalamu, I loved it so much. Thank you so much for this beautiful work.
Well, thank you very much. And I appreciate this comment that you've made, because without delving into age and asking you how old you are, you've been doing this for a long, long time. And you've seen a lot of writers come and go. You know,
And I've been knowing you for like 30 years now.
Yeah. So it says a lot that you rank Walking Blues as one of the...
It's one of the greats.
Yeah.
It's one of the greats.
That you enjoy. Thank you.
Can't wait for the rest. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Blue Cypress Books presents a gothic murder mystery party with Jess Armstrong, author of The Secret of the Three Fates, a Ruby Vaughn mystery. Thursday, December 5th at 6:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Tickets are limited. Coming up later this month, Michelle Dumont, author of a new children's board book titled Phoebe Cakes the Bulldog, a Mardi Gras Tale, will be the featured speaker at the annual Jefferson Parish Children's Book Festival at 9:30 a.m. Saturday, December 14th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Free and open to the public. Dumont will discuss advanced techniques for crafting relatable characters, constructing stories that captivate young readers, and enhancing narratives with vibrant illustrations. Other children's authors will be present as well, including Gary Olipio, Karen Conarth, Louis Duet, Laura Roach Dragon, M.H. Herlong, Leah Eskin, Laura Michaud, Gideon Hodge, and others. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.